to the Tennis IQ podcast. I'm Josh Berger.
And I'm Brian Lomax. And today we're going to delve into a topic that Josh and I have discussed in the past, which is self-talk. But we're going to go into really a specific case within self-talk that you all may, or some of you may experience yourselves. I think in talking to Josh, the two of us have experienced this in our tennis careers. And this is the idea of automatic negative thoughts. And just to explain what that is, and so I'm working with a client, and this is also something I definitely experienced around the same age as my client, where when a mistake is made or even just a point is lost, there's just this really visceral negative reaction, which can come in different forms. It can just be maybe slamming a ball into a net, saying, "I suck," or "You suck, you're so bad." Sometimes it comes out in really mean rhetorical questions, like, "Why'd you do that? What are you thinking?" It might come out in sort of, I guess, maybe like shoulds and oughts, or things that you have to do or need to do. Like, you have to be better than that. You need to be really good at the beginning of this set. And then there are also times where we tend to catastrophize what's going on. If you lose this match, you're never going to play college tennis. You're never going to amount to anything. So we take a small thing and make it into something much larger. There are other, I would say, examples of these types of automatic negative thoughts. But what I have seen, especially with this particular client, and I have personally experienced, is that these thoughts are, as the name says, automatic, but they're so, you don't even know you're doing them to a certain extent. And even after you've done it, it almost doesn't feel like you were in control of that particular reaction. And so I think this is it, maybe a flavor, Josh, of self-talk we haven't exactly gotten into, but it's something that's very likely some of our listeners have experienced. We've experienced it, that, you know, the sport of tennis in some ways, I would say, perhaps promotes this. Because of the complexity of the scoring system, because many of us come to tennis with a dislike of making mistakes and losing points, it can be hard to react to that. So one of the things that we want to get into today, and we might even call these ants, which Dan Abrahams, the sports psychologist from the UK, works in soccer or football a lot, he calls these ants, automatic negative thoughts. And really distinguishes between thoughts and directed self-talk. So we're going to talk about how to deal with this conundrum, these automatic negative thoughts. How do we counter those? How do we eventually reprogram those? Before we get into some of that stuff, Josh, I just wanted to hear, you know, your thoughts on the topic, and maybe some strategies that you want to explore as we go through this case.
Yeah, well, first of all, I was excited when you brought up this topic as an idea, because it's something that, as you said, we've both been through, both on a personal level, and something, you know, that I see with my clients, and I would venture to say that most tennis players have been through this, where they're in a certain situation, both in a match or during practice, where maybe they're not playing well, or they're missing a certain type of shot, where they're losing, and you start to hear these same sorts of things over and over again. And you brought up a certain examples. Maybe it's their backhand, for instance, that they struggle with more, and they they start saying, "Oh, my backhand is horrible," or "My backhand sucks." Or they start saying, "Oh, I'm so bad at tennis. Why am I even doing this? Why am I even playing?" Or worse. So I think it's a very relatable topic. And when you brought it up, actually, it got me thinking to some of the strategies that the book Chatter talks about, which I know that you've read as well. And, just through reading it, currently starting to, look at that book and starting to look at some of the strategies and how these can be applied so that we can, help tennis players get out of the mode of just simply responding, sorry, simply reacting to the situation with whatever thoughts might be going through their mind, and trying to get more into the mode of responding in a, you know, in a thoughtful, intentional way. And I think the book offers some good strategies that we can definitely get into. But I think, you know, you brought up Dan Abrams, and one of the things that he says often, which, you know, I talk about with clients, and you know, I think is very helpful way to think about a lot of this type of stuff, is to you know, listen to yourself less and talk to yourself more. So not just listen to every single thought that could be going through your mind, but try to, you know, talk to yourself in an intentional way, plan that out or script that out, and have a specific plan for, you know, how you're going to be communicating with yourself, what your self-talk is going to be looking like during a match.
And I think, at least in the short term, we should understand that it's okay to a certain extent to have some of these automatic negative thoughts. The key is recognizing it and following up. So let's have an example. Let's say you hit a shot in the net, like that example you said with the backhand. All right, man, my backhand is so bad. We can't let that thought stand, meaning like it can't be the thought that continues on into the next point. That's the danger of that automatic thought, that it may even spiral into a little bit more. If we can have that awareness, hey, that's just a thought, and I need to follow it up with maybe more scripted self-talk, it's okay. Let's focus on the next point. Maybe even visualize the correction of the backhand, which we have talked about in other episodes as part of our routine. So it's okay in a way to have these automatic negative thoughts. The key is kind of squashing it in the moment and following it up with a productive thought that keeps you focused on, you know, what's important in this moment. I think that that also is something that's very in line with acceptance commitment therapy. We talked a lot about that with Dr. Laura Swettenham in our Think Aloud episode. And, you know, it's accepting the thought as just a thought. You don't have to listen to it. You're not obligated to follow its advice. And then the commitment piece is committing to your own personal values, whatever those are, and then committing to right action, the action you want to take. So it's very similar, I think, in terms of like the ACT piece and what Dan Abrahams is talking about with automatic negative thoughts. And so that when the next point begins, we've ended it with good deliberate self-talk. We haven't let the automatic negative thought be the thing that permeates that time. So I think that that's a necessary process for players to go through, especially as they begin to understand these automatic negative thoughts, as they become more aware of them. But that's really the first key, Josh, is really understanding that you're having these things. And, you know, the client that I mentioned earlier, you know, he's not so, in a way, he's not so aware in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
He's aware after a little bit, and then tries to rationalize a bit, perhaps, what's happening. But, you know, we're trying to build more awareness in the moment. And I think that is a place where we can go back and perhaps do a self-talk log. Also, this is maybe where Think Aloud could help also, right? Where you're recording what you're saying. You actually get to hear that. And although, you know, we both know that for the recording, some people may filter anyway. But as they get more and more used to being recorded, it'll probably be, you know, more genuine self-talk coming through there. But even if there is some memory decrement, it's useful to write down what you said. And then to begin to understand that. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, there may be something like that in chatter about understanding what your self-talk is and maybe even journaling about it. Could be wrong on that.
Yeah. Journaling was definitely brought up as a useful way to start being, you know, noticing and being aware of your self-talk and starting to, you know, improve on it as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I was just going to say, I'm glad that you brought up the awareness piece. And I really think that's a foundational piece to all of this, where if you're not aware of the way you're currently talking to yourself, if it's become so automatic that you don't even notice it, you know, until you get to that point of awareness, it's really tough to make it, you know, to make a change and to do something new. So I really think that's the first part. And also when it comes to awareness, I actually think this ties in quite well with this concept of mindfulness and meditation as well, where, you know, I think through practicing mindfulness, through, you know, having some sort of a meditative practice, you can start to simply notice what's happening. You can notice a thought, you can notice a physical sensation, you can notice a sound, and rather than just reacting to it, you can start to, you know, again, it's a skill, but start that process of simply being aware of it, noticing it, observing it sort of from an outsider's perspective. And then once you do that, then you can choose your response more so rather than just reacting. So what it's really doing, what being aware really does, or at least it starts that process of starting to slow things down. It starts to, you know, create a little bit more of a gap between that stimulus and the response, and gives you the chance to, you know, pause and choose how you want to respond in that moment. And I think a big part of that is, how are you going to talk to yourself in that moment?
I think you're right on that. We're trying to widen the gap between, and I often refer to this as, at least in terms of understanding it generically, not stimulus response. I think generically it's stimulus and some action.
Mm-hmm.
You get to determine whether that action is a reaction or a response. We want it to be a response. The greater the amount of time between stimulus and action, the better chance you have of it being a good response. But in this situation where we've got automatic negative thoughts coming, there's very little gap between what happened and that thought. It's boom. And that's the piece we want to widen more. And we widen that through, as you said, Josh, mindfulness and meditation, because you begin to understand how your mind works. When you are doing something like meditation, you're simply observing your mind. And even in meditation, you may have negative thoughts about yourself or what you have to do or what you've done. And we want to look at those thoughts with curiosity, not judgment. Maybe that's interesting. Why do I think that? Or what could be behind that? And so the more that you're able to observe your thoughts, the more you're able to widen that gap between stimulus and action so that we can make it stimulus response going forward. So I do think mindfulness is a great long-term strategy for building this awareness. And I think that's useful in a number of ways for tennis players. Along the lines of journaling your self-talk, is one of the more classic approaches to dealing with self-talk is something called rational emotive behavior therapy, which is understanding that a lot of the self-talk examples we used were not rational, or those negative, you know, automatic negative thoughts are not particularly rational all the time. And part of journaling your self-talk is going through what's called an ABC process. So A is for what's the activating event. So what triggers these automatic negative thoughts? Is it a mistake? Is it losing a point? Could it be, you know, some other situation? So you want to understand all of the different situations in which automatic negative thoughts could get triggered. And then B is about the beliefs and attitudes that you have that lead you to say these things to yourselves. So the client I'm talking about often will tell himself, I think, things that are negative about his self-image. Things I don't even think are true, but he thinks to a certain extent, or is conflicted on that, which is interesting. So sometimes he does think he's not good at tennis, and sometimes he does, or has this notion that he is, but then isn't, because he's not always perfect on the court. So I think it's helpful to list out what those beliefs and attitudes are that are leading to these automatic negative thoughts, And then the C is for the consequences of these negative thoughts. So when I tell myself I suck, well, how does that affect my performance? How does that affect my confidence? How does that affect my motivation? How does that affect my ability to control my emotions on further points, etc.? So the more that you understand the consequences, perhaps it leads you to a place where I need to change. And that, I think, is an important concept, Josh, that we should go over a little bit. And I don't know if you use this much in your practice, but not everybody's always ready to change. So something people can Google is something called the trans-theoretical model of change, right? You've got these different stages of change, and it's good to know where you are on that continuum. Are you in a pre-contemplation place? Are you contemplating change? Are you in a place where you're about to make change? Are you in a maintenance mode with your change? It's good to know where you are. Because I've worked with some clients, Josh, who just weren't really ready to start doing some of these things. And that's okay. We can work with that and try to help them get through those stages. But everyone who's listening to this also has to know, have you reached a point where you're kind of sick of talking to yourself or having these negative thoughts rule your emotions on the tennis court?
I think that's a helpful way that you broke that down or explained that, because I think, you know, when it comes to change, the person who's involved has to be, you know, has to sort of take action. You know, they may be working with a sports psychology professional on some of these things. They may be, you know, going through that process with them, but it really does have to come from them in terms of, you know, really wanting to make that change, being ready to make the change, and then taking the necessary steps. And I think, you know, when it comes to you know, self-talk, and when it comes to, you know, starting to notice what's happening, starting to take more of a distanced approach, which again is one of the strategies from Chatter in terms of, you know, how can we not feel like we're in the middle of this, but almost trying to view it from an outsider's perspective, trying to sort of view it as like if you were a fly on the wall, like what would you be seeing? They talk a lot in that book about how sort of seeing it something from an outsider's perspective, right? Seeing the event, but also seeing what that self-talk sounds like or looks like from an outsider's perspective can help you, you know, make the change. So, you know, I think once somebody can, you know, go through a log and, you know, really write down, you know, okay, what was my self-talk like in that moment, or, you know, the, you know, going through the think aloud protocol or think aloud method, like we talked to Laura Swettenham about, you know, it starts to create that awareness, and you can imagine, hey, what does that look like from an outsider's perspective, right? What does that look like from the fan in the stands perspective? And it starts to help people see things a little bit more objectively and creates that distance. So it doesn't necessarily feel like it's happening to them and doesn't maybe feel as personal, but it creates, you know, the conditions needed to, you know, sort of view things in a more objective, almost scientific way, like, okay, this is the way it is, rather than this is something that's happening to me.
Yeah. And I think you're getting at the heart of ACT and REBT, which is we have to come up with what to say instead. And, you know, this outside perspective, and I think we've touched on this in a couple of other episodes, is I like to think of it as your coaching voice. And the best way to bring in your coach is to use your name. All right. Hey, Brian. You need to talk more positively. You need to get focused on this point. And you start using second person you as a way of doing that. And, you know, I'm looking back on my own career, and I didn't do that in my own head, but I actually had a real coach come up to me and have that conversation with me. And it did snap me out of it to a certain extent. It made me at least explore options to try to deal with my automatic negativity that was getting out of control. at a certain point, and it was so much worse in practice than it was in matches. And later learned, a little bit more why that was. At least for me, it was I wasn't going into practices with really great specific goals, so therefore my mind was all over the place, and hence I wasn't as focused. Therefore, I was making more mistakes, and then I'd get more upset. In matches, I would always be more focused, so I'd make fewer mistakes, and I wouldn't get as upset. So that was something that helped me. But I actually had a real coach from an outside perspective come in and let me know what that was. What Ethan Cross is talking about in Chatters, you can do that for yourself. You can take yourself out of the problem and look at it from a outside perspective, look at it from a solution perspective by using your name and then talking to yourself in the second person. So, Josh, the coach, is now talking to Josh, the player. And that can be really, really helpful in also bringing a more rational, objective point of view to what's occurring in that moment.
Definitely, definitely. I think that's been my biggest takeaway from the book, and I think it's something that's very applicable to tennis players, because if you're constantly saying like I can't do this, or my forehand or my serve, it feels very personal. There's not that sort of gap that's needed, and they refer to it as almost like an emotional distance that's needed. Because when you're using your name, it does feel like you're talking to somebody else. So it's a way, he refers to Ethan Cross, the author of Chatter. He refers to, overuse of the first person as I talk, where, where you're using the word I and, things like my and me and things like that a lot. And actually in the research, it is a reliable indicator of negative emotion as well. So it's, all of this type of stuff is certainly backed up in research. It's just a matter of, how it's applied and how can, people who are listening, tennis players, start to use it. And I think one of the biggest, most helpful things you can do is using your name. And I think it can sort of snap you out of whatever sort of funk you're in, as a instructive way to handle a lot of different woes of tennis players, whether it be performance anxiety, whether it be a lack of focus, whether it be handling frustration or anger on the court. I think it's a it's a very actionable tip that people can use and try it, see how it goes, right? Try to use it, and it, like anything, it's a skill to be able to start using it and to see the impact that it has. Glad that you brought that up, and I think that's something that can be very useful for people out there.
And the players that I've used that with, or have asked them to use it, have reported really positive results. They occasionally will forget, of course, but the more that they do it, the better that has gone. So that's really important. I feel like some of these things around rational emotive behavior therapy, even ACT, they're strengthened as techniques if we also take a longer term, deeper dive into why are these your automatic negative thoughts. Because as I said earlier, I think it's good, or you should accept the fact that you probably will have some automatic negative thoughts, but the key is to follow it up with what we were just talking about. Maybe it's good coaching talk, maybe it's something else. It's got to be something that's more productive. But is there a way to update what you automatically think of? And I think I would say yes. There is, or at least to minimize the ants that show up. And my particular orientation to working with clients is two-pronged. It's a lot of like what we just talked about, different cognitive behavioral or psychobehavioral techniques. But there's also a philosophical perspective in which we try to develop better ideas behind how you think. And I think that comes through wanting, first of all, to upgrade your own personal philosophy, maybe develop your own personal philosophy of performance excellence, developing better mindsets and attitudes, better beliefs and attitudes. And this does take time. This is reading of books and articles, and I would say repetitive reading. So one of the things that I can't remember if we covered this in our conversation with Bill Tim, because we had to, like, remember how we had to re-record that one? Because I screwed up the first one. And it might have been covered in the first one. But one of the things that Coach Tim did with the tennis team at Vanderbilt is he had them read a book called The Greatest Salesman in the World. And the idea of even the book, if you're familiar with it, is that you read it repetitively. And I think one of the times that you read it, you should be reading it out loud. And so there are these 10 scrolls, and the idea is to read each scroll 3 times a day for 30 days. And through this repetitive reading of really good quality information for your mind, it will help to begin to upgrade your thoughts, upgrade how you think. So, you know, that's a potential, you know, book that people may find useful. It does have some, I would say, religious overtones. So if that's not, that's something that doesn't make you comfortable, then that doesn't have to be that book. Although I wouldn't say it's overwhelming in that regard. I think it's still worth looking at. But the idea of repetitive reading of something, I think, is something that is helpful. And in fact, another book that's good about self-talk in a different way than chatter is Shad Helmstetter's What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. And that has a lot of content around developing self-talk scripts for perhaps different issues that you're having with your thoughts. So in the area that I mentioned, or one of the areas I mentioned earlier, was players having some self-image problems. You suck, you're so bad. You could write a self-talk script that addresses really the truth, because the reality is this player I'm working with doesn't suck. He isn't so bad. When I said those things, I didn't suck, or I wasn't terrible at tennis. These things aren't true. And so your self-talk scripts can really be about, well, what is the truth? What do you aspire to be? What do you want to be the truth? And they can be a couple of paragraphs even. And the more you read that, or you could even record that particular script and listen to it, the more that you're feeding your mind these great ideas, the more your automatic thoughts are going to be oriented toward these new self-talk scripts that you're working with. That takes time. It could take anywhere from, say, 30 to, you know, 70, 90 days of working with those types of scripts. So you have to have the patience and the willingness to do that. But it's not really long and hard stuff to do, maybe 10, 15 minutes a day working with shaping your mind. So I do think that when people look at their automatic negative thoughts, be thinking about some of these techniques that we've discussed, but also be looking at, how can I upgrade the way I think? And even just getting into, you know, philosophical books like Ryan Holiday's books, you know, Obstacle is the Way, Ego is the Enemy, Courage is Calling, Stillness is the Key. These are great ways just to begin to think about things differently. And I would say, Josh, you already brought up mindfulness. That's another great long-term strategy for helping you become aware, but also helping you understand how your mind works.
Absolutely. And I think there are definitely, you know, a number of ways. I think there are some maybe practical things that, you know, that we haven't, when I say practical, I mean like things that people can really bring to the court with them, even tangible in a certain way, like a note card, which is, I know, something that we've talked about as well. And I think all of these things that we're talking about, whether it's, you know, the repetitive reading, whether it's having a deeper understanding of some of, you know, these philosophical topics like you're bringing up, I'm glad you brought up, you know, Ryan Holiday, for instance. I think his books are really excellent. And, you know, so I think through using a note card and through developing it and, you know, having it be a working document where this can change over time. This is not set in stone, but, you know, having something that you bring to the court with you, and maybe you, you know, look at it right before the match. Maybe you look at it during, in between sets or during certain games. Maybe, it, you know, some one player that I'm working with, she always, it's part of her routine now. She gets to the court, she takes her rackets out, she takes, you know, water out, and she takes the note card out, and it sits there. And maybe, you know, maybe she looks at it more or maybe less on a certain day, but it's a part of the routine. And, it, and that note card can include certain mental reminders. It could include certain self-talk or certain, you know, things that you've scripted out that you want to say to yourself or that you want to say to yourself in certain moments. Could have strategic reminders as well. You know, you can, I think, structure it in different ways and have different categories. You know, I think what's nice about a note card is that it's limited in size. You're not writing paragraphs here or not writing an essay on the note card, but I think that's a nice way to, you know, have that reminder. I mean, I know we've thought of referred to it as a reminder system, you know, have that reminder with you on court, something that, you know, you can refer back to. It's like having a coach there with you that's, you know, telling you all these things that, that you need to hear. I mean, we've talked about how in the heat of the moment, when you're out there playing a match, it can be very hard to remember some of these things that you want to keep in mind. So when you're, you know, maybe in a calmer frame of mind, when you are able to really focus on, you know, what would be most helpful, creating something like that, going through that process can be really helpful when you're actually out there and, you know, you need those reminders.
And I think the creation of that, because I'm a huge believer in that as well, Josh, and I have had personal benefit in my own playing career from such thing. The creation of that as part of your preparation for the match. So let's say you have a, you know, your first match is on a Saturday. This could be a great Thursday or Friday activity. Is all right. What do I want my reminder sheet to be? What do I want my on-court coach sheet to be? And as you said, it could be they could be process goals. They could be game plan reminders. They could be mental reminders. They could be mantras. Whatever. You could even do little drawings if you wanted to. Something inspirational for you. So that's a great way, I think, to prepare for the match or the tournament that you're going to play. Because, for most of us, when we're playing, don't get the benefit of a coach coming out and talking to us. So we have to create that system for ourselves so that we don't come off the court and say, ah, I wish I had remembered to do that. You know, it's too late at that point. And I think your point about your player, that she pulls it out of the bag when she sits down is important, because if it doesn't come out of the bag at that point, it probably never comes out. It needs to be seen as part of that process. So that's something I say to all the players I work with as well. When you sit down and you pull out your rackets and all the other stuff, the note card or the note sheet has to come out with that. And it can have a lot of great stuff to help navigate some of those automatic negative thoughts that you invariably will encounter during matches, because tennis is tough. It's natural to lose points. It's natural to make mistakes. You're only going to win maybe 50%+ of the points, which means you're losing the other 50% or slightly less or slightly more. And you're going to need some help managing that process. So why not build a system around you to help deal with all of that and help then instruct your self-talk to be as productive as possible within that moment? And again, I'll just, you know, go back to the deeper, longer term work being very helpful in this process. So I think when I say the longer term work, you know, sometimes as sports psych professionals, we don't always get to work with somebody for a long period of time. That can depend on a number of factors, but sometimes it can be maybe only 4 to 8 sessions. That's hard to do, that deeper, longer term work when it's like that. The clients who I've worked with for more like 6 months plus, We're able to do more of that stuff. And it's almost at that 6 month point that things really start to kick in with how they're thinking. They begin to think better. They begin to mature in a different way, et cetera. So that's just something to think about because you could do that work on your own. You don't have to do that with a sports psych professional. And if people are interested in a selection of books or articles, feel free to let us know at tennisiqpodcast@gmail.com. We'd be happy to provide some thoughts on that for people who want to get started on developing their own personal philosophy of performance excellence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's, it is a good place to start. As you said, as sports psychology professionals, we don't always have the chance to do it. I think, there are factors, whether they be budget or time or priorities, that do, that are taken into consideration. But I think it is a important starting point, important foundation. Why do you play your sport? What do you enjoy about it? What values do you want to be living by? And I think that's definitely something I am trying to incorporate more into my work. Where I find sometimes, we get straight to some of the mental skills and trying to put them into action, which I think, people are at times asking for. But I think when you can sort of start with, start with some of these deeper questions, it makes a lot of that work easier.
Most definitely. And I think it's really worth it from for both sides. I think from you as a practitioner, you feel like you're doing better work there because of your ultimately, why are we all really doing this? We're not doing this to become just great tennis players. We're really doing it to become better people. And tennis happens to be a vehicle in which we can practice our ability to be competent and good at things. It's a place where we can exercise control. It's a place where we can relate to other people and be social. And through these processes of learning to be, competitive and have good definitions of being competitive and have more purpose. This isn't just about tennis, it's about life. And so when we delve into some of those deeper issues, maybe even those more existential issues, I think everybody feels better about what they're doing. And so it's really valuable work, not only from a practitioner standpoint, but I find that the clients that I work with, when we get into this stuff, they really enjoy that aspect of things. And that's cool to see that I mostly work with players between, say, 13 and 22. And even the younger ones, they really enjoy this aspect of that. And we're talking about this so that it can help people upgrade how they think, which also can help hopefully minimize the number of automatic negative thoughts that we get that can be harmful to our performance.
No, absolutely, and the impact of that is, goes far outside of tennis or outside of their sport. Where, I think one of the big takeaways that I have, and one of the things I'm often, happiest to hear about, with people that I work with, is when they're able to, use the things that we talk about outside of their sport, in, in school, in their relationships, and their work, right? Just viewing these, these skills, these mental skills, this new way of thinking as, something that you can apply to all areas of life.
For sure, for sure. So fascinating episode. I think maybe we ended up in maybe a place we didn't expect, talking more about the philosophy piece and that deeper meaning of why we play. But I think it's a good place to bring our listeners to and to explore that a little bit more. So thanks, Josh. Great conversation. For more on today's episode, please check out the show notes. If you have any feedback or questions for me and Josh, please email us at tennisiqpodcast@gmail.com. You can also use the Twitter hashtag tennisiq. Additionally, please subscribe to the show on your podcast platform of choice, including YouTube, so you can be notified of new episodes. And you can also check out our Instagram account. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon in our next episode.